We're looking at dumbing down religion this morning. And the passages that were read just a few moments ago in Hosea chapter 4. If you notice in those passages, it talks about how my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And when you think about that, that's kind of a deplorable state. Lack of knowledge, because they had all manner of opportunity to obtain this knowledge. But there was a flaw, and the flaw was in the priesthood. Like priests, like people. The people were exactly as the priesthood had become, and it's summed up finally that they were being disobedient to God. There's where it's all at. And so the priests had kind of dumbed down religion. Now, for those that are not familiar with the expression of dumbing down, this is something that appeared, I don't know how many years ago it was now, maybe about 5 or 6, maybe longer than that. It was really used primarily and almost all the time to discuss what was going on in education. And the idea was it was a deliberate, intentional effort to reduce the standards of achievement. In other words, make it easier for the students. Don't ask them to meet the challenge of learning. Simply minimize the standards. It assumes that the bar has been too high, so let's lower the bar. And then that was the dumbing down of education. That's contingent on an argument that the kids can't handle the higher bar, so we lower it. And then the hope is that grades will then increase. The grade average will go up. Well, here's a real curiosity. Grade averages have not raised as supposed, even though there's been this dumbing down. They've generally remained the same in some places, despite the dumbing down of the standards. Grade averages have actually decreased. I think that there ought to be standards set, and the standards ought to be set high enough in whatever it is in life that you're trying to reach a standard. A little bit of difficulty has never hurt anyone, especially when it comes to bettering themselves. I remember whenever I heard that expression about dumbing down education, I thought, well, isn't that kind of similar to what happens sometimes in religion? That sometimes the standards in religion are kind of dumbed down a little bit. They're reduced. There's, you know, well, we'll just lower the bar, so to speak, and make it easier for everybody. I don't think we ought to be making it harder for everybody. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, I don't think we've just got to make it, just take away all this, a whole bunch of standards and just make it so easy that we've almost made it meaningless. And if there is this dumbing down in religion, then we're going to end up with people who have a certain lack of knowledge. Like it says back here in Hosea. And sometimes those who are responsible in doing the teaching are going to be held accountable for that kind of thing. Now, I know sometimes there are those that want, well, we want this, we want that, we want the other, we want a certain kind of preaching and so on. The Bible even speaks about this. But see, we don't want to come up to the standard. We want something less. Kind of like another Old Testament prophet was said, well, you know, the people wanted to hear smooth things and things that were pleasant to them and so on. So yeah, I think there's a dumbing down that takes place in religious matters as well. And I think that's been going on for some time. But let's just talk about things in the last, I don't know, half century or so. Here's what the problem is. Book, chapter, and verse preaching has just about been disdained. In other words, we really don't want to hear that anymore. And so, well, we'd like to hear other things besides, you know, just getting up there and just thumping on that Bible all the time. And because that kind of preaching is disdained, there's a popularity in which people are captivated by motivational type preaching. Watch on television. The most successful television preachers, are they up there preaching book, chapter, and verse? No, they're not. What are they doing? Well, they're motivational type preaching. And they're quite good. And what they have to say is quite motivational. But now, it's not really the kind of preaching that's going to be saving souls. There's also the smoothness of pop psychology. That's not so much thought of anymore. But again, it's pop psychology is coming up with ways in which things can just be dismissed and passed over as though it's inconsequential. There's also sometimes, if you do hear the gospel message, it's in sound bites. Just a little bit, just maybe enough to satisfy saying that, well, there was some of the Bible in there. I remember my mentor telling me one time of going somewhere to a gospel meeting. And a man got up, read some passages about Dorcas, and he said, and then spoke for 45 minutes. And the last time we heard the Bible was whenever he read about Dorcas. You wonder, what could you talk about for 45 minutes? But he did. And so it was a gospel message in sound bites, you know, just a little bit, just enough to kind of say, well, you've done this. Now, another thing that's happened in the last few years, and I'll tell you what, if you look at the history of things, you see where this is possible. Now, we went over this in Bible study last year, how we got the Bible and that kind of thing, and the tremendous burst all of a sudden from about 1960 on of all these different translations. Translations are, and they're said to be easier to read. Well, okay, and they're easier to read. Now, is that a good thing or bad? Now, some people think, oh, that's a great thing. And the one that would be the easiest to read would be the best one. Well, if that were so, you think that one, who is the easiest to read, would be leading the market in Bible sales. And they're not. Surprisingly, it's not. And though that might seem to be a good thing, it's really not all that good. Because the translations that are easier to read, well, they kind of back away from essentially literal translations. In other words, you know, we want to know what it means. Here's the language it's translated out of, Greek, and into English. Now, try to do this as essentially literal as you can. You can't do it absolutely literal because it's one language to another. And you got things like grammar, syntax, idioms, and other things. And you can't come off there word for word. You can't do it. But it can be essentially literal. You take the wording and the meaning and you have to put it in another language. And you put it in there so it functions well in that language. But we've had this backing away from essentially literal translations. And there are some. The King James Version, the New King James Version, the New American Standard Bible, the American Standard Bible of 1901, and even the English Standard Version, which is relatively new, is essentially literal. But what we've had this eagerness for dynamic equivalence, is what they're called. Now, a dynamically equivalent Bible translation is one that says, well, these are the thoughts. And we're going to get the thoughts across to you. Well, who decides what are the thoughts is the first thing. And when you start doing that, it becomes not a translation as much as it becomes a commentary. Somebody's read this in the original language and they decide, well, this is what it means, and then they put it out there. That's quite different from it being actually a translation. And there are dynamic equivalents, Bible, the New International Version's one of them. That comes to mind, and there have been others. Now, I actually read this book. It's by Leland Ryken. It's called The Word of God in English. That's the book over there. That's a picture of it. Not very good. Didn't come out very well, but it was really a good book. It's right up my alley, and I really liked it. He had a quote on page 91 that says this right here. To put it bluntly, what good is readability? Now, remember, people want, oh, we want a readable Bible. The easiest one. Well, what good is readability if a translation does not accurately render what the Bible actually says? What good is it? Now, he doesn't give an answer in there. Let me give you what my answer is. I don't think it's any good at all. If it can't get across what it actually means. So we want Bibles that give us the Word and tells us what this means and lays it out there for us so we can read it and understand it. Yeah, we might have to puzzle some of it out, but you know, give us the words. Don't give us something else. Don't give us what your thoughts are on those words and other things along that line. Now also included in this, part of the problem is that there's a blurring of standards. It just becomes hard anymore as to what's right or wrong. And I think we see that all the time. We've got more things and more things that were wrong then and are right now. Or they were right then and they're wrong now. It's amazing. It's enough to keep a person thoroughly confused for about a decade or so. And then guess what? All the standards change again. So you go through it. I can remember being in college and hearing all this. And I was trying to get in line, you know, with what everything was being said and so on. 5 or 6 years later, all that I heard in college, everything I learned, everything I thought I had sorted out, all gone, all different. And it just keeps going on like that. But so there's been this blurring of standards, and part of the reason for a blurring of standards, especially in religious matters, is because, well, there's a lack of teaching. That happens. That's right. Not teaching the Bible. Now, there may be times whenever it might not exactly be what a person's maybe really interested in, or it's not really generating, you know, a person's thought process and other things like that. That happens. But we always ought to be doing the teaching of the Bible. There's also, sometimes there's the finger that's pointed at the teaching. Uh-huh. Well, how about this, that there could be a lack of learning? It's not always the teaching. Sometimes it's the students. I would never say this, but old brother John T. Lewis down in Alabama, he was a preacher down that area for about 60 years back at the first part of the last century. He was teaching a Bible study, and they had a man that was coming there visiting. He'd been coming for some time. And after several weeks, he got to grumbling around about what Brother Lewis was teaching. Now, Brother Lewis was a man, he was known not to mince his words, if you get my drift. And the fellow finally went up there one time and told him after the Bible study, he said, "I didn't get anything out of that Bible study." And Brother Lewis said, "You didn't bring anything to put it into." You know what he meant, didn't you? It's not always the teacher. Sometimes it's a student. I'm painfully aware of that from my learning experiences as well. I'm sure we all are. Sometimes I'm the problem. Sometimes we're the problem. The best teacher in the world, it doesn't get, well, sometimes maybe it's me. Could be. That's right. So it may be a combination of the two. That's right. But it's not always one way. And then sometimes there might be the best teaching and there might be good learning, but you know what happens then? Well, there's a lack of application. It's never put into practice. That kind of defeats everything right off. Now, some symptoms of the problem. Let's look at that for a few minutes here. Some symptoms of the problem. Well, there's this idea of continued weakness. Now, I understand that Christians can be weak. I understand that completely. And the Scriptures even address this. Look at Romans chapter 14. In Romans chapter 14 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul here addresses this. Now, notice what he says, receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. It's not saying someone who's wrong in the faith. It says someone who's weak in the faith. So can we just say, yeah, there are people that are weak in the faith? Sure. Sure, the Bible does mention weakness. No question about that. But now here's the thing. That's not supposed to be permanent. Now, I have met more than a few individuals who it seems like weakness is a permanent state with them. And I think sometimes that there's a certain amount of comfort in being weak. because, well, I'm weak, so there's nothing much expected out of me. I won't be asked to contribute much. Another thing, you see how that might be comforting to some folks, to kind of want to remain weak. That might really be their comfort zone. And there's no safety, though, in continued weakness. If a person admits that they're weak in the faith, all right, that's not really a crime or a sin or anything like that. What really then is, what's next? You know that? There's the thing. If we admit some kind of a failure or a lacking of something, whatever the case is, if we admit we've done something wrong, if we admit, well, I've sinned, what do you do about it next? That's the thing that really matters. So here we come along. Well, I'm weak. I admit that. I'm weak. All right. Well, what's going to happen next? In other words, what are you going to do about the weakness? Are you doing something to get away from the weakness, you know, to become strong, to strengthen, you see? And that's how it is. I did sports when I was in school. Tried to do a number of them. I just wasn't any good at basketball. I just wasn't. But boy, I mean, if it came to running, I was pretty good at that. And I loved baseball. We didn't have hockey down there, which they had it, but they had baseball. And I always had a problem with, you know, just if the ball was a breaking ball. Boy, I'm telling you, the hardest thing in the world for me, and, you know, if kids threw a breaking ball, it was one of these big old rainbow jobs to come in there like that. So what they did, they started way out there. You know, if it's right-handed, they started way out there to this way. Well, I'm a right-handed batter, and most everybody I ever batted against was right-handed. So if they were going to throw a breaking ball, they started out right at me. And you know what I wanted to do? Well, you can't hit anything stepping away from the plate. Well, I had to learn how to hit a breaking ball, and that meant I got to stay in there and hang tough and wait on that thing, come down there and break across the plate, or I'd never hit it. And that's the hardest thing in the world to do because you're thinking about your personal safety and you want to get out of there. Well, if it's not a breaking ball, well, then you learn to duck. But you know, the thing of it is, I knew what my weakness was, and I had to work on it to get better, to get to where I could hit that thing. And we learn everything in life is like that. Whatever you have a difficulty doing, hopefully now, you work at it until you get better. So you were weak at something, and you became strong. That's how that works. In so many things. There's no safety in continued weakness, and we are expected for our weakness to disappear and be replaced by strength. Now here's another one. Look at Matthew chapter 12. In Matthew chapter 12, now this is something, again, that I think happens so easily that we may not realize it's going on. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30. Now Jesus says here, "He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters abroad." You see a third position there? You see one kind of in between? He who's not with me is against me. Does he say, well, now there's some out there, and they're a little bit of both. Or they're not, you know, that kind of thing. Well, that's what's called mediocrity. That person out there in the middle that's willing to accept, well, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know, doesn't matter. We used to have this thing at work, always tickled me to death. We'd go out there and we'd hurry up and we'd get something done, get it running again and so on. And he'd be kind of limping along and there would always be somebody on the maintenance crew that would look at it and here this piece of machinery is and it's just limping along, barely, and it's perfect. Well, no, it's not perfect. You're just willing to accept mediocrity is what it is. And call it that, all in a joking way. We're not joking this morning. And Jesus wasn't joking there. There's a willingness to accept mediocrity. And Jesus said, no. No. But despite what he says, there is this willingness to accept mediocrity. There's a, you know, there's this, it's a tacit acceptance of occasional attendance. Yeah, it happens, and you know what? We just kind of say, well, that's what happens, and and it's mediocrity, and well, just kind of willing to accept it. Yeah. And then also there's sometimes, in some cases, there's just a refusal to make a decision. It talks about the double-minded man in James. Every time I see that, about the double-minded man, I think about the person, you know, driving along. How about this person driving along in their car, and they come to a fork in the road. Now, they didn't know that fork in the road was there. This is long before the days of Garmin and all that other stuff. They didn't know that fork in the road was there, and they come up there, and they don't know whether to go this way, to the left, or to the right. Well, they just sit there. Well, you're going to have to make a decision. Pick one. Can't do it. There's some people who just can't do it. Cannot make a decision. And once again, you know, well, we'll just accept mediocrity. Maybe just give it all up by not making some kind of a decision. Now, the next one's a big word. It's compartmentalization. And that means that we're willing, you know, to kind of just set things in certain places, like pigeonholing things. So, you know, this is a sin if those other people do it. But now, if it's over here, if it's with me or some member of my family, you know, well, that's not a sin. If they do that kind of, you know, that's how this kind of thing works. Or well, it's for this, or well, it's for that, and we all, you know, it's making, you know, excuses right and left. James chapter 4, him that knows to do right and doesn't do it, it's sin. You can compartmentalize it all that you want. But we come over here, see, we come over here, well, in regard to certain commands. Well, now there's some commands, and they don't apply to me. You know what I hear a lot anymore? I hear a lot anymore whenever we see something that's commanded in the Scriptures, or there's something in there as an example, or anything like that. I hear this now. This is what I'm hearing now. Well, I'm not comfortable doing that. I'm not comfortable with this. And I'm not comfortable with that. And I'm not comfortable with the other. So if I'm not comfortable, well, we'll just kind of just let it go. And if this is something that's my duty to do, well, I'm not comfortable doing that. So I guess that means it's all right. I'm not comfortable changing my life. That would be repenting. I'm not comfortable confessing Jesus as the Christ. I'm just not comfortable doing that. How many other things could happen? I'm not comfortable to be baptized, because what it might mean, other members of my family might get upset and I wouldn't be comfortable. Oh, here we go. See how that is? So we put it over here in some compartments. Well, I can't do that because, you know, it's over there in the non-comfortable compartment. So in regard to commands or in regard to something in worship, I'm just not comfortable doing this, or I'm more comfortable doing that. And you can understand how that kind of thing goes. So that sometimes are the symptoms of what's going on when we're dumbing down religion. Now let's talk about the solution. Talk about this in a positive way. I want all of you to turn to 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 2 through 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 2 through 4. It says here, now, preach the word, be ready in season, out of season, convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. When we read that passage, I'm sure many of us think, well, that's that other guy. That's the other person. That's not me, but somebody else. And I'm sure I've been guilty of that myself in times past. But now, I look at this and I think about the seriousness of this. And there's all three aspects of preaching the word is right there in verse 2. Now, it mentions in there the idea of reproving, whatever your translation has, reproving. That means convincing. That's maybe the easy one. Then you come over there to rebuking. I'll have to admit, that's a hard thing to do, and I'm not really comfortable with that all the time. But my comfort doesn't matter. Sometimes that's something that needs to be done. I have never done it in my life, called out one person from up here in the pulpit. Never. I came this close one time to doing that. I had made up my mind, if it didn't change that day, then the next Sunday I was going to call a person down. I wasn't looking forward to that kind of a thing. But I felt like it was something that had to be done. I was convinced it had to be done. Exhorting, that's a little easier too. But all these things, you see, are based on what? They're based on this right here, teaching. If you're going to reprove or convince, you're going to have the doctrine to back it up. Same as with rebuking and exhorting. That's the only way it will work. Now, exhorting a congregation to be more like Christ is fine if they know what Christ was like as revealed in the Bible. If they've been taught what Christ was like. Or exhorting folks to do more work for the Lord is fine if they've been taught from the Scriptures what the Lord's work is. People are encouraged a lot of times about doing the Lord's work, and they get all wrapped up and involved in this thing. Sometimes it's just not what the Lord's work is in the Scriptures. It might sometimes even be a good thing that's suggested, but it's not the Lord's work. Exhorting the people to love the Lord and one another is great if they have been taught the nature of biblical love. I think too many times people get this idea in their head that they love the Lord and they love the other brethren like they love, I don't know, their husband or their wife or a brother or sister or something like that in some family way or some emotional way. And we've substituted that in there. Well, that's not what biblical love is. But see, if there's not a failure to be taught these things, then exhorting people to do things that they've not been taught, it's not going to work. A failure to have a scriptural foundation is a prescription for disaster. That's right. That's part of the solution, see. You got to have the right foundation. Now, when you think about this right here, not having a scriptural foundation, a prescription for disaster, I want you to look at what Paul has to say, Romans chapter 10. He addresses this. I think in Romans chapter 10, in the first few verses, you really get a glimpse at the personal side of the apostle here. He really lets you in, you know, to his feelings. That's important nowadays, you know about everybody's feelings and everything like that, you know. It's like a few years ago when it got to be real popular, you know. Well, you need to get in touch with your feminine side. I had somebody tell me that now. One time a member of the church said, well, Terry, you need to get in touch with your feminine side. I finally told him I don't have a feminine side. I don't care if you get in touch with that. And then all this thing about burying your feelings and one thing and another, and I'm thinking, I don't know. That's just, that might be good in some ways, but, you know, it ought to be in measured doses, so to speak. But here you get to see the apostle's feelings. He displays them when he talks about Israel in Romans chapter 10. Look at verses 1 and 2 with me. He says, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. Who's going to argue? There he is. It's his heart's desire. He's letting out his feelings here for his countrymen. And I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God. But then he says it's not according to knowledge. Now, if there's a failure to have a scriptural foundation, that's a prescription for disaster because you're going to end up with zeal without knowledge. You know what that's like? Zeal without knowledge is like? It's like having a souped up car without a steering wheel. How would you like to do that? You know, get in, start it up, press on the gas pedal. Oh, there's no steering wheel. Well, that'd be kind of a disastrous thing. And that's right. It would be. So we've got to start with knowledge. We've got to start with teaching. That's the important thing. There's where the foundation is. And once we've got that foundation laid, then we move on from that. We ought to also never feel comfortable in our weakness. The Hebrew writer actually rebukes this. Supposed to teach Bible class here at the conclusion of what Brad's doing. Brad's doing a great job. And this is something that I want to be spending a little time on when we get to that. In Hebrews chapter 5, in verses 12 through 14, For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you, now what, again? The first principles of the oracles of God, and you've come to need milk and not solid food. Now, I want you to stop right there. When I read these verses, every time I read them, I see between the lines that the writer here is disappointed. You ought to be teachers. But no, you need someone to teach you again, the first principles, the oracles of God. And you still need milk and not solid food. He's disappointed. He goes on to say, everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised, discern both good and evil. He's disappointed, and yeah, he's rebuking them there for this. You ought to be stronger. You ought to be teachers. But no, you can't hardly even handle the milk that you should have progressed from. Peter encourages growth, not weakness. He doesn't say that it's all right, that being weak is some kind of an acceptable thing. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 2, he says, now as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word. Now notice this. Watch this now. That you may grow thereby. Oh yeah, you'll grow from milk. Exactly. For the babe, that's right. But what happens out here in the real world with babes that are on milk? What happens with them? Well, eventually, you know, they grow up a little bit from the diet of milk. And they move on to what? They move on to other things that they eat. Solid things. And including, at some point, they transfer over to a diet that includes meat. And that's how you grow. And even at the end of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, you grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So he's encouraging growth there. Whenever you talk about growth in one thing or another, it's whatever it is. It's milk, and then that develops, and you grow thereby, and then you come to a diet where you're able to handle meat and so on. And kind of like it's also saying there in Hebrews chapter 5. But now here's the real question when we think about this. Are we doing the things necessary to be stronger? Now each one of us is going to have to answer this question. Are we doing what we can to be stronger? Remember now, don't feel comfortable in our weakness. Are we doing this? Well, it's 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 10. How we know this passage. He says, therefore, brethren, now watch, be even more diligent to make your calling election sure. Now we know that part of it. Are we doing that? Are we being diligent? Are we really trying to make our calling election sure? Are we doing what we can to be stronger, to be growing? It's not that you're going to come along and then there's going to be this eureka moment where you've just got everything and it's all going to happen all at once. It's not. But the thing of it is, has there been any change, any improvement? Has there been any growth? You see, you know what Jesus said back in John chapter 15 about the branches that weren't growing on the vine? Cut them off. Cut them off. They're taking away from it. Well, that's a hard statement, isn't it? I think that it is. But again, it's showing that growth is expected. The Lord expects us to grow, not just to continue in weakness. And also, we're not supposed to settle for mediocrity. I don't know about you. Let me ask, how many folks in here would like to go to a restaurant and order a meal, and it comes back, and you got half the food, and the food that you've got is half done? You want to accept that? No. I mean, there'll be people just, you know, oh, no. What about, you know, if you had a flat tire, take that in, stop in there someplace, and they take the tire off, they find the place where there's a hole, and they stick a food in there, put the tire back on, they air it up, takes 32 pounds in the tire, most normal tires, and they put about, I don't know, 18 pounds in there. Oh, that's good, that'll work. I don't know about your car, but my car, if it's got 18-pound air in one of the tires, it's doing this all the time. Wherever that tire's at, it wants to go that way. We're not going to accept that. We're not going to accept mediocrity in most things. We wouldn't accept mediocrity in a mate that we had. Unfaithful to you half the time. How's that going to work? We're not going to do that. We should rather desire excellent things, like it says in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 10. Excellent things. We should desire those things and want those things to be a part of us as well. And we're to strive for maturity, it says. It talks about, you know, the former things in Philippians 3, verses 13 through 16, about the former things. But I put all those things behind me, and I press on toward the high calling of God. You know, we've all got a past, we've all got a history, yes. There's this, there's that, there's the other. Sometimes, you know, we talk about that's our baggage, that's right. But sometimes we've got to leave that baggage behind and move on to other things, to maturity. And Ephesians chapter 5, now I want to turn to that one, I want to read that one. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 27. It says, now this is that Jesus, that's the He, might present to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. That pretty well rules out mediocrity in that passage. Not spot, not blemish, none of those things. Holy, without blemish. You see the idea there. And we are also now expected to do all, not just some, of what God says. It's not a smorgasbord where we can go through and just pick out these things and that things and the other and let the others all just go. We know the passage, John chapter 14, verse 15, where Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. You know, someone will say, oh, I love Jesus. Well, are you keeping His commandments? I worked with a man at work. His son worked there also. One of my best friends at the gypsum plant. They were both just notorious, at least in my thinking, for saying how much they loved the Lord, but they didn't keep His commandments. So that discounts then you're saying that, because if you love the Lord, you'll keep His commandments. Well, who says that? Jesus said that. I think each one would call the shots on what loving Him is. And so, loving Jesus, the manifestation of loving Jesus, is keeping His commandments. Which ones? All of them. He didn't give us a list of what ones to leave out. He even said in Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, He says, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. How many things? All of them. All of them. And you know the interesting thing about this, people look at it and they think that's a daunting task. Well, of course it is. I'm not going to stand up here and waste your time or mine telling you that it's easy. It's not. But I'm going to tell you what. If you get in the habit of doing these things, it becomes easier. If you become accustomed to it, it becomes easier. Continual practice is what makes it easier. So you set your mind and yeah, we can do these, and then you're adding to these things, you know. Like it says in 2 Peter, you add to your faith certain things in there. You don't add them all at once. Some of them maybe a little bit more at one time and another, and so on like that, back and forth. But you're adding all the time. And pretty soon you'd be surprised how many of these become easy to do. The wise man, you know, in Matthew chapter 7 about the wise man built his house on the rock, the foolish man built his house on the sand. We know all that. You know, both of them, it says in there, heard these sayings of mine. Both of those men heard these sayings of mine. The foolish man heard these sayings and he didn't do them. But the wise man heard these sayings of mine and he did them. And it was the wise man that stood. So from that we learned that the wise man does the things that God says needs to be done. And then again, you know, we're not supposed to be out here in the business of picking and choosing. Matthew chapter 23. This last verse we're going to look at, and the lesson is yours. In Matthew chapter 23 and verse 23, Jesus says to the scribes and the Pharisees, "Woe to you, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So what were they doing? Well, they were tithing the small herbs of the garden and leaving the other things out. Well, it's good that you're tithing those things from the garden, but it's not good if you're leaving these other things out. You can't just pick and choose and think that's satisfactory. He says there, well, you know, these things you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So yes, there's a certain amount of dumbing down of religion, but now we come down to this, and it's kind of a simple matter. Are you doing all that you can to please the Lord? That's where we end up. A dumbed down religion is not going to help you to do that. And it's going to prevent you from doing that. Now, if you're here today and you are a Christian, then be all that you can be. Do all that you can do. That's what we ask. But now, if you're not a Christian, then you need to take matters into your own hands and obey the gospel today. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, if you're willing to repent of your sins, to turn your life around, confess Him before men, and be baptized this very hour, you become a child of God. And if you do that, you'll be following what's said in the Scriptures and not some other dumbed down version of how you can become a child of God. Do what's said. Now, today is a day and an opportunity where you can lay hold unto eternal life. We're going to sing a song of invitation in just a moment. This is the right place, and this is the right time. If you would like to obey the gospel today, why don't you do so while together we stand and sing.